Welcome to the Between the Lines podcast, a weekly literary author interview program produced by WABE Atlanta.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and this is Between the Lines. Many of us know that recently Atlanta has become known for its hip-hop, R&B, music production, touting such stars as Ludacris and Outkast. But did you know in the 1920s, Atlanta was bursting at the seams as the busiest, richest metropolis in the South and one of the first music recording centers in the country, drawing companies like Columbia Records? A new kind of music, though, was born here, but within the old confines of racism and police corruption that permeated Atlanta at that time. My guest today spins a great story with this background in The Dying Crapshooter's Blues. I'm delighted to welcome author David Fulmer. Thanks so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, what a book. It was really fun to read, and I'm a blues fan, too. As a matter of fact, my husband Maynard and I used to drop in at Blind Willie's Blues Club here in the Virginia Highlands neighborhood in Atlanta. But I did not know until reading The Dying Crapshooter's Blues what a significant role he played. I mean, not only in the novel, but in the development of the blues. Just share a little bit of that with us, if you don't mind.
Well, Willie McTell was one of those really unique individuals among a group of blues artists. And most significantly, because his biography seemed to, he lived the story of the blues in the first half of the 20th century. He came from the country, he came from middle Georgia, where, and he moved into the city, which is when he came to Atlanta, as the music itself did. He was also just a unique and fascinating and brilliant guitar player, singer, and entertainer. And what a lot of people don't know is that he played everything. He not only played blues, he did spirituals, he did popular music, he did ragtime. He was just as you can tell if you hear a little bit of him speaking, he was just a marvelous entertainer and interacting with his audience. Mm-hmm. So he was a rare one, and I was happy to have him introduced as a character in the book.
So Blind Willie is asked by little Jesse Williams, a sporting man, dying from a gunshot wound administered by a drunken white cop, to write a song for him so that people won't forget him. But before we get into the story too far, I want to ask you about a few definitions for our listeners, okay? First of all, what are sharps and rounders? Because they were mentioned a rounder this or, what are sharps and rounders?
Well, those are named, sharps comes from card sharps. Oh. And people often misspeak that word as card sharks.
Oh!
Yeah, it's actually a card sharp. It's someone who's sharp with cards.
Oh.
So it's card sharp. A rounder is sort of someone who might be unemployed. He'd be out on the street, what you might call a player today. He just gets around, and he might do a little bit of pimping. He'll do some gambling. He'll do some petty crime. But he does not hold down a regular job unless he absolutely has to. And it's an old 19th century term for someone who just gets around.
What about sporting men?
Sporting man is someone who sporting was a euphemism for what we call the scarlet trade or the economy of sin or red light. So a sporting man, usually he worked the ladies.
So a pimp, right?
A pimp.
Okay. All right. Now, you mentioned Terminal Station. Is that the old underground where the where
yes,
underground
it's, that's what became underground. Well, yes.
Okay.
There were two. There was Union Station and Terminal Station in downtown Atlanta at the time when Atlanta was the most certainly the most significant transportation terminal as it is today in the Southeast. That started a long time ago when Atlanta was a huge, huge rail hub and played a huge part in the city's history and also was part of the story of the music that was created here.
Okay, now Hunter Street you mentioned in the book, but it's now what street? Martin Luther King, is
yes,
it?
Yes.
Martin
right.
Luther King, okay. And you mentioned Cathead Biscuits.
Yes.
What are they?
Well, those are biscuits, and you can still find those here and there in the little country restaurants. They're biscuits that are about the size and the shape of a cat's head.
Oh. Okay. All right. What is the tower?
The tower was a Fulton Tower, and it is now on the site of the Fulton County office, the Fulton County government offices. And it was a very tall tower that had administration buildings, and there were also the jails were inside there. And it was for a long time, it was the tallest building on the Atlanta landscape. And there was a yard behind the tower where people were executed by hanging.
Ooh.
There were gallows in the yard.
Yes. Wow. So that's right down where City Hall and Fulton County
right
Administration Building
corner.
Is
yes,
now?
Yes, right.
Very interesting.
Fulton Tower.
Okay. And the last one, what are coon songs?
Coon songs were a body of music that came after the Civil War and in that period of Reconstruction. And they were often done by minstrels, white minstrels in whiteface. And they were essentially...
In whiteface or blackface?
In blackface, I'm sorry. in blackface. And they were essentially these very demeaning, very stereotypical songs that were supposedly written or sung by or about coons.
Oh, okay. Because I know Blind Willie refused to do coon songs.
That was something that it's a huge body of music, and that was very popular between the 1890s and around 1920. They really began to fade away. But it was a very recognizable term for a certain kind of music.
Okay, so now let's get into the story. So,
okay.
We're talking about the crap shooter here is little Jesse Williams, and he's found by Joe Rose, who's a notorious rounder like little Jesse. And he's asked by Jesse to track down his killer. Tell us about Joe Rose.
Joe Rose is one of those men who basically rambled about the South at the time when the whole country seemed to be in motion. It was the first wave of urbanization, and a lot of people were on the road. Joe Rose is one of them. He's he's sort of a rambler, and he's a gambler, and he's also a jewel thief. That's really how he makes his money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the second story in Dying Crapshooter's Blues. But because he's of the criminal class, he associates with people like little Jesse Williams, and he happens to come upon the scene of Jesse's shooting this cold December night in Atlanta, and is drawn into it. And because he has a little bit of background as a policeman, a little bit of background as a Pinkerton detective, and mainly because he's Jesse's friend, he is asked to investigate why this white cop walked up and shot him down.
Now, little Jesse is a black gambler, right?
He is.
But what is Joe Rose?
Nobody really knows.
And I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, and Joe doesn't know himself. He's probably a Native American. He's probably Indian, and to the best of his knowledge. He came out of an orphanage, and he was never really told, and his features are sort of ambivalent enough that he can sort of fit in any direction. Most likely he's a Native American, but because of that, he can slide back and forth across the color lines very easily.
Yeah. In spite of his criminal resume, Joe Rose is really, to me anyway, he was a sympathetic character. I mean, like you said, he navigated between the black and white society and so forth. But he's caught between a rock and a hard place, getting pressure from Little Willie to find his murderer. But at the same time, there's this guy called the Captain.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, his last name is Jackson. But anyway, the Captain is pressuring Joe, too. So how is he going to take care of that? Because the Captain says, if you don't find me the guy, you know, I'm going to...
Right. Joe's caught in the middle between two opposing forces. One is his friend, little Jesse Williams, who's been shot down and has no idea why, and wants Joe to find out. On the other hand, the same night that this shooting occurs, there's a jewel theft in an Atlanta neighborhood called Inman Park, which was the first sort of, quote, suburb, unquote, of Atlanta, and it's where all the rich people live. Mm-hmm. And there's a theft of some jewels from one of the biggest mansions in the neighborhood.
So it's a Christmas party, and all the rich and the elite are there and so forth.
And the mayor is there. The mayor is there. And, it's, of course, the mayor is...
Who won the election on a Get Strong Against Crime platform.
Exactly, and he is completely embarrassed that right under his nose, basically, these jewels are stolen. Well, this character called the Captain, Captain Grayton Jackson, no relation, decides that Joe either did it or knows about it or can find out about it, one of the three. In any case, he gets pulled in and he's on the carpet. So now he's in between the two. He's got to worry about who shot Jesse, and on the other hand, he's got the Captain on him. And as the story progresses, we begin to think that maybe there's a connection between the two, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And Joe is really kind of committed to find out for little Jesse who kills him, because they've got this superstition that you can't deny a dying man. It must be among the rounders and the sharps, you don't deny a dying man his last request.
A deathbed request. You cannot deny a deathbed request. And that actually plays into the song and plays into the title, because in addition to that deathbed request, which was kind of grim, he also, little Jesse, asked Blind Willie McTell to write a song about him, and that song actually is a Willie McTell song called "The Dying Crapshooter's Blues."
A real one that's on the CD, right?
It's on the CD, and as a matter of fact, on the McTell's Last Session CD, which he recorded here in Atlanta in 1956, he talks about how he created the song and how Jesse asked him to do this for him and sing it over his grave. And so that is a plot thread as well.
Well, if he's just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines of The Dying Crapshooter's Blues by David Fulmer, who has written about blues, jazz, and other subjects for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Atlanta Magazine, and NPR Radio. His first novel, Chasing the Devil's Tail, was winner of the Shamus Award for Best First P.I. Novel, and he wrote and produced the acclaimed documentary Blind Willie's Blues. You know, David, I've heard that often these ballads become myths, you know, from that they make up about people like little Jesse, and that they really kind of go through years and generations being tweaked, you know, for a little local color here and there. But I wonder why is that? How do they?
Well, and I'll get a perfect example is this song, "The Dying Crapshooter's Blues," which originated. The original version of this is about 300 years old, and it's a song called "The Unfortunate Rake," and it's about a rake who is like a rounder, but that was the British word for it, who is dying outside a hospital in London, St. James Hospital. This is going to come back, St. James Hospital, and he tells someone. He describes what he would like to have or to see or enjoy before he dies, and he makes this whole sort of list of things that he wants. Well, that song traveled across the ocean and landed here, and it split off into three or four different other songs, keeping the same sort of melody and chord structure very generally. It became a song called the St. James Infirmary. That jazz song. It also became a song called The Streets of Laredo, which is a cowboy song. It also became a song called The Gambler's Blues or the Dying Gambler's Blues. In this case, it was The Dying Crapshooter's Blues. So what Willie McTell did, this is how brilliant he was. He took this actual incident, which apparently really did occur on the streets of Atlanta. He took this actual incident and this song that he must have heard long ago, because it was around in different forms. It's also blues fans will recognize the Hesitation Blues is kind of the same song. He took that song form and created this brand new song and raised little Jesse Williams to, like just what you said, to the level of a mythological figure. The song is sad and it's hysterically funny. It's sexy and it's very moving all at the same time. And it just shows what a genius he was and how this minstrel tradition carries on.
Little Jesse was a gambler, night and day. Well, he used crooked cards and dice. A son of a guy get hurted, but had no soul. Heart was hard and cold like ice. Jesse was a wild, reckless gambler. He won a gang of change, and a many gambler's heart he led in pain. When he began to spend and lose his money, he began to be blue and all alone. But boy, his heart had even turned to stone. What broke Jesse's heart while he was blue and all alone? Sweet Loreen had packed up and gone. Police walked up and shot my friend Jesse down. Boy, I got a dead of day.
Let's get back to Joe Rose for a moment. Joe Rose's biggest problem, as we mentioned earlier, was Captain Jackson. But I don't know, it might have been Captain Jackson's nymphomania wife, May Ida. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about her for a moment quickly.
Well, May Ida is sort of a natural force. and, of course, a lot of men would like to meet her, someone like her.
Is that what you call it, a natural force?
Well, it's a euphemism. But, you know, May Ida is one of those rare... is a woman who is completely at ease with her sexuality and her overactive libido. But of course, at the time that we're speaking, we're still in the throes of the post-Victorian age. It's the beginning of the roaring 20s, and the flappers are coming along. But still, most women were still stuck, frozen in that Victorian ethos.
Mindset, huh? Mm-hmm. But you know what, though? I kind of thought maybe she was schizophrenic, had multiple personalities from some of these.
Well, and that could have
in terms of her not remembering what she had been and done and stuff like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, she could. I mean, May Ida is a really complicated character, and she's. I think part of her problem is she's driven by these natural desires, but which she can't really. Well, she tries to satisfy it as hard as she can, you know, but, and I think that's got her so conflicted. And yeah, I think that she's a little bit crazy, but the thing is that she's such an, such a wonderful, sensual being that it's okay that she's a little crazy.
Well, does her husband?
Well, and he's really crazy because he's and the way that I pose it, he's completely the opposite. He's a total cold fish who really only cares about his job and the power that he can, you know, lord over other people.
Joe Rose is attracted to Pearl Spencer, a beautiful black woman whose brother, Sweet Spencer, really hates Joe Rose. What's up with that?
Well, Joe is. Not someone you would really bring home to mom. And Sweet is very protective of his little sister. And he's just come out of prison and Sweet has just come out of prison. Pearl has dabbled in crime. He's worried about her. The last person he wants her to be hooked up with is the likes of Joe Rose. But those two are drawn together like magnets. Mm-hmm. And as the story progresses, we start to wonder if Pearl's got something in the middle, got her hand in the middle of all this business with the theft of the jewels, and that's one of the two mysteries that plays out through the book.
Right. Are the characters like Sweet Spencer and Little Jesse and the Captain, are they fictional or based on some real people?
I do use real historical characters in all my books. And in the Storyville books that you mentioned, and this one, of course, Blind Willie McTell is a real character. But my fictional characters are basically assembled from different places. I put them together from spare parts, from people that I've known over the years, that people that I've known about, somebody that I might have worked with, and marrying that up with maybe some other little bits and pieces. But yeah, they're made from spare parts.
Actually, you cover the history of the name changes in Atlanta quite quickly and succinctly. Atlanta founded as a backwoods depot called Terminus and then still...
Marthasville?
Yeah, Marthasville and by the governor's daughter or for the governor's daughter. And now, of course, Atlanta, that you said some engineer threw out as a whim when it was selected for the North-South Railroad line.
Nobody knows why or where that came from. And apparently this engineer that was doing some railroad design said, you know, we need to change the name. Arthursville is just a little bit too
country
or provincial, and said, how about Atlanta? And so it's been ever since.
A side note that was very interesting was you saying that Jefferson Davis sealed the fate of the Confederacy when he refused to order that these railroad lines
exactly.
be destroyed.
Right. Well, that's, you know, with my books, you get a history lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and historians will dispute all these things forever, especially the Civil War, especially
right.
that drama. But I can tell you that there were in the research that I did, I found that there were a lot of the opinion that it would have been a different story if he would have gone ahead and torn up the rail line so that Grant couldn't get his troops in quite so quickly. It probably would have come out the same, same in the end.
But he also made it easier for Sherman to march to the sea, too,
right.
by
yeah.
using—
Sherman, I'm sorry. I said Grant.
It
would have, that it made it that much easier for Sherman, but it would have come out to the same in the end. It was just the forces were just so massively overmatched. But the other thing, the good side was that the rail lines were still there, allowed Atlanta to thrive immediately.
Helped her to come back.
To revive from the ashes.
Yeah. Earlier, I spoke of a new music being born here, because music was still segregated in the 20s. What was different about, was it George Purcell and Jake Stein you mentioned in the novel? What is it that they represented that made the difference in this new music?
What was happening in the early 1920s was the birth of the record business in a major way, and there were three places in the country you went if you wanted to make a record: Chicago, New York, or Atlanta. And because the same things we talked about with the rail lines, Atlanta was in this unique situation to not only draw blues artists from all the way across the Sun Belt and up through the Carolinas, but also what was called at the time hillbilly music down from the mountains.
Mm.
So you had this unique situation, and everybody that was recording would send their people, like this fictional character, George Purcell, and his assistant, Jake Stein, to Atlanta with a portable recording machine in the back of their Model T. And they would set up in a hotel room or maybe in a radio station or something like that, and basically put out a cattle call.
Auditions. Huh?
And put out auditions, and people would show up. And it wasn't any of this, okay, I want to try that again. You did it one time, you got one chance, and that was it. That was your song. So I used that as a subplot, and that McTell got to record, though those recordings are now lost.
Mm. Well, share the story about how he got to record, because as a black man, the hotel the two guys were staying in
was a segregated
– right. Right. So.
Well, he showed up. He was a blind man. And one of the things that's really, again, fascinating about Willie McTell is how unbelievably clever he was about all kinds of things, including using his blindness to his own advantage. And in this case, was like, well, I didn't know any better. I'm blind. Though there were stories that of him being able to tell a $1 bill from a $5 bill by feeling it, all these things that become almost preposterous. But he had a rare sensibility to feel his way through life, and this was a situation where he got himself into recording.
One of the things that I think you pointed out was that George Purcell and Jake Stein didn't specify race when
right.
they were seeking.
Well,
people to come in, which meant that they were started recording black
right.
music. They
yes.
knew that everybody could have well. People had started buying radios, poor people, mm-hmm. Rich people as well. So
and the record
every
company,
class
right.
was being
Absolutely.
Was having access.
Yes. And I'm one of the things that I return to, and I did in my Storyville books as well, is that before baseball was integrated, before the U.S. Army was integrated, music was the first place where blacks, whites, Italians, whoever happened to be on whatever side of the color line could play together, could work together as equals and be accepted. So my belief is that music was the first break in the color line, and that happened here. When these people came to Atlanta, they were recording both. They came from New York mostly. They were recording. They were looking for both black artists and the hillbilly artists because the market was there, mm-hmm. because people wanted to buy those records. And anybody could afford them.
You obviously have a deep appreciation of music, especially jazz and the blues. How does music, if it does, how does it shape your work?
Well, everything that I write has a soundtrack. And it's either about musicians, there's music playing in the background.
Now, do you mean this literally, or are you writing it in the script that there be music in the background?
No, no, I mean in the book that there's somewhere there's music playing.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, and you're going to hear, you're going to hear it in your head because I'm putting it in the book.
Right.
But everything I do, I've always been, since I was a kid, completely fascinated and engrossed by music, and especially American music. I think it's probably our most significant export. It's the one thing that has made it around the world that everybody loves and everybody knows. And it identifies us as a country in ways that almost nothing else does. It's our music. And it comes from the grassroots. It comes from the bottom up. It's really who we are as Americans.
You made an interesting side note in there, too, about how cultures really were oral before they were literate. And so, therefore, the music was
was their literature. It was how they told their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back thousands of years, really until the print age, as, you know, Marshall McLuhan would describe it. We were all oral culture. And everything that we had was passed down. Almost nothing was written down because nobody could write.
And there was a point you said because you can hear things before you can see them.
Yes.
Many oftentimes.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. And that all plays into this, and especially in cultures that are sort of pre-literate or not literate cultures, music becomes their news, it becomes their entertainment,
right?
All of it.
We both mentioned earlier your Storyville stories, mm-hmm. and that's based on Saint Valentine? How do you pronounce it?
The main character's name is Valentin Saint-Cyr, and he is a Creole. And those books are set in the Storyville, the red light district, Storyville of New Orleans, in the first decade of the 20th century.
Once again, about jazz and music.
Yes. Right. As a matter of fact, in the first book, the one that won the Seamus Award and was nominated for the LA Times Book Prize, Buddy Bolden, who is pretty much regarded as if anybody invented jazz, it was Buddy Bolden, plays the other lead to Valentine, and the subplot is that jazz is being born as this mystery of the murder of some prostitutes in Storyville is going on. At the same time, Buddy Bolden is slowly losing his mind. But the birth of jazz is a significant subplot in that book.
Thank you so much, David, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
David Fulmer's latest book is The Dying Crapshooter's Blues. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Dave Baraswain. Technical producer, Ken Murray. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Funding for this program is provided in part by the UPS Foundation and the Fulton County Board of Commissioners under the guidance of the Fulton County Arts Council and the Georgia Council for the Arts. Between the Lines is a production of WABE.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.